This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of action at the state legislature yesterday. We're going to focus in on one issue they covered, school accountability. When the state assembly introduced a bill in January outlining how the state would hold publicly funded schools accountable for academic performance, reaction was strong. The bill included some controversial measures, including a process for turning chronically underperforming schools into charter schools.
The Senate's bill never included that option, and a new amendment introduced in the Senate Tuesday removed several other measures. Here to make sense of what's next for school accountability in Wisconsin is Aaron Richards, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter. Aaron, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
Well, back in January, there were some pretty controversial proposals on the table for school accountability, including changing failing public schools into charter schools. Where are we today with all this?
Well, we're at a much different place, although I would say that from the very beginning in January, that both the Senate Republicans and Assembly Republicans had pretty different ideas on how they would deal with poor performing public schools. So any accountability bill is looking at how to basically judge the quality of your public schools. The second half of that is, what do you do once you determine that a certain number of schools are doing really poorly over time? What should we do with those schools? And that's really the crux of where we're at right now. The Senate has introduced an amendment that is a pretty toned-down version of an accountability bill that would essentially it would not turn failing schools into charter schools. It would allow the superintendent some ability to intervene in the schools, and the superintendent has some of that ability right now. And it pretty much keeps things the way they are. And that's not what the Assembly wants. The Assembly would really want to see sanctions for poorly performing schools. They've made that their position from the start. They say to have any kind of accountability bill with teeth, you have to have something happen to poor performing schools. Without that, in the Senate version, it's likely that there won't be a compromise this session and we'll just kind of continue the way we are now, which is that all schools will get a report card every year about how they're doing. If they're public, eventually the voucher schools will be wrapped into that same report card system. But at the moment, there wouldn't be any hammer that would come down on poor performing schools and sort of, from the state level anyway, make them change in significant ways.
Well, did any of the Assembly proposals from January make it through the Senate version?
There's probably the biggest nod to the Assembly version that the Senate put in was sort of this notification process that essentially would have public school districts notify parents in some way, usually it looks like by posting on a website, all of their options of schools to attend, even if they're not district schools. So basically forcing the public school districts to notify in some way of parents of all their options that they could potentially go to besides the district. Failing schools or schools that get low or, you know, kind of the lowest category of score on the report card would also have to send a letter to parents that basically notifies them that their child is attending a school in the lowest category. So that's kind of the biggest nod to what the Assembly would like. And I think, you know, the Assembly leaders are saying that that's just not enough.
Why have the Senate and the Assembly had a tough time agreeing on school accountability measures? Where are the lines in the sand that have been tough to cross?
Sanctions are probably the biggest stumbling block. And it's an interesting issue because the Republicans control both houses, yet they have not been able to agree on the idea of whether there should be sanctions for failing schools, and if there are sanctions, what those sanctions should be. In part, that's because some of the more moderate Republicans in the Senate believe that just switching the management of a failing school, we know a lot of those are in large urban areas, especially Milwaukee, that just changing the management of those schools won't necessarily lead to reform. But then you have the Assembly saying, listen, a lot of these schools have performed poorly over time. We need to make a change. They want to make a statement. They want to show that, you know, they're sort of being aggressive on chronically underperforming schools. And so that's where you just can't see agreement between both these houses, even though they're all in the same party. There's the sanctions appear to be the biggest stumbling block.
We're talking about school accountability here in Wisconsin right now with Erin Richards. She is the education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And let's talk a little bit more about what is in this this Senate version right now. Now, one thing is that it accounts for the allowance that the state superintendent could intervene in poorly performing public schools. Tell us about that measure.
So the superintendent could, in conjunction with the school board and the school superintendent, talk about what kinds of changes could happen in that school that could potentially help improve the situation. Now, that's pretty broad. That could mean a number of things. I think it doesn't necessarily mean that the state superintendent is going to come swooping in and, you know, demand that the school board replace the principal. But it could mean that the state works more closely with that district or that school, or probably all of them as a team, and says, listen, what are some more supports we can do here? What's the biggest thing holding you back? In many cases, poor-performing schools have high populations of kids in poverty, kids coming from rough backgrounds, high mobility. There's a lot of other issues contributing to the low performance other than just, you know, a simplistic view of teachers not working hard enough. That's not usually the case. So you could see the state superintendent work more closely with the district on, you know, various practices that could improve the conditions of the school.
And the Senate version also has schools rated into 5 performance categories. This is instead of giving them letter grades. How might that work?
Yeah, so that's another important point. The governor in his budget had requested that all schools be given a letter grade. We have these school report cards now, schools would be graded A, B, C, D, F. Critics say that's really polarizing. You don't really want to give parents a report card that says their kid is attending a D school or an F school. People on the other side say, hey, listen, whether we call them significantly exceeds expectations or, on the other end, fails to meet expectations, there's still 5 categories. It pretty much means the same thing. But especially on the Senate side, there's some agreement that the categories, which again are on a scale of, you know, significantly exceeds expectations, or in the middle, meets expectations, that's just a more specific way of describing the school that doesn't distill everything down into sort of a polarized letter grade. According to Luther Olson, who's a longtime senator and a former school board member, he says, you know, besides the governor, nobody else really wants letter grades, even though that's been something that's been applied in other states. So you don't see that in the Senate version. I think that you would find plenty of support for that in the Assembly, but that's not in the version that we're looking at now that the Senate is likely to pass.
And it sounds as though in the Senate version that if a school finds itself in one of these, the lowest performance category, then parents will have to be notified.
Right. So that would mean that every parent, and I think it's pretty clear, I had to check on this yesterday, but it would require whether it's a public school or a public charter or a publicly funded private voucher school, that they would all have to send a letter or some kind of notification, maybe electronic, to parents that just says, hey, just so you know, you're attending a school that's in the lowest category. So that would be a change from what we have now. At the moment, school districts, you know, the data is publicly available, and most districts post their report card on their site, and many communicate with parents anyway, but this would put into state law that parents attending the schools in the lowest category would be officially notified of their school status.
Now, we know that the Assembly is not on board with, they haven't gotten what they wanted out of the Senate version. How closely does the Senate version align with what the governor may have wanted for school accountability?
You know, the governor signaled in his budget that he was more interested in parents having lots of information about their schools. So rather, instead of, you know, he was never really going publicly anyway down the we must have sanctions route. His position appeared to be if we just give parents enough information about these schools, they'll make better choices, or they'll make choices that would serve to reduce the number of failing schools or lowest performing schools, and they would choose higher performing schools. I think you'd find quite a few critics that say simply educating parents may not be enough. That might not be a strong enough step. But that's kind of what the governor had wanted. So this is, I mean, I would say this is fairly close to what the governor wanted, although it certainly doesn't include the letter grades. But it does go down the path of saying, you know, here's more information about the school. This latest bill also tweaks the report card for schools now, which would require DPI to basically add in some more measures or adjust the metrics to better account for the fact that high poverty schools are going to have traditionally lower test scores. So how do we adjust the report card to reflect growth over time, growth with the same kinds of students that are in the school, to make sure that schools that are at least helping low-performing kids become higher-performing get credit for it? The worry among the Senate is if this doesn't get passed and the Assembly doesn't come up with a companion bill to match, that nothing is going to move forward on school accountability, and we'll have what we had at the end of last session, which is the voucher schools join the report card, but that's about it. That's the major change. There's no sanctions.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Aaron Richards at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the latest on school accountability legislation in Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a look at the latest news on Governor Walker's presidential hopes.
First, Wisconsin's Budget Writing Committee held its first executive session yesterday. It marks the beginning of a process in which they officially hash out what goes and what stays in the governor's budget. The budget will still likely change once it goes to the full chamber, but this step is key in determining what the final draft will look like.
One of the first steps of the committee took yesterday was to remove 14 non-fiscal policy items from the budget. They also voted to end funding for the state Citizens Utility Board. Here to tell us what the Joint Finance Committee did yesterday is Patrick Marley, state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
So yesterday, the Joint Finance Committee removed 14 non-fiscal policy items from the budget. And the biggest headline from yesterday is its decision on the DNR. What did they decide?
So the governor had proposed to make the DNR board advisory only. It wouldn't have any policymaking powers at all. And that got a strong reaction from both Democrats and Republicans, many of them questioning that move. And so this decision was made actually by the two leaders of the committee. They didn't need the full committee to act. But they said that that was an item that they deemed pure policy, didn't have an effect on the state's finances, and so it should be dealt with as separate legislation. They pulled it out of the budget. That effectively kills it. So the DNR board would retain its current powers.
Now, it's worth pointing out that technically that is a non-fiscal policy item. Is it normal for a governor to put non-fiscal items in a budget?
It is a time-honored tradition to include policy in a budget from both Democrats and Republicans, and it is a time-honored tradition of people opposed to that policy to decry including policy in the state budget. Members of both parties say they try to minimize it, but the state budget is invariably ends up having a fair amount of policy in it.
What was the tone with Alberta Darling and John Nygren yesterday as they went about changing things and making decisions?
Well, so the two of them that are the co-chairs of the committee, and they just put out a memo that said these are the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is a nonpartisan group that helps legislators work on the budget, presented a list of about 50 items that they deemed were policy. The two co-chairs took 14 of those and just put out a memo saying these are the ones that are coming out. Then they had a day-long meeting where they voted on individual items. The 16 members on the committee are made up of 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats. And, there are big disagreements between the parties, and so virtually every issue the Democrats raised concerns, dissenting opinions. They really disagree with these policies, but for the most part, the day was entirely polite, and everyone sort of listened to each other and had their votes.
As we said, there were 4 non-fiscal policy items. We talked about the DNR. What else stands out to you from yesterday?
The other policy items that came out that were of note was one, the governor had proposed making some pretty significant changes to the way property is assessed to have it done at the county level rather than the municipal level, with the goal of having that be more uniform across the state. The John Nygren, the committee co-chair, said that he saw merit in doing something like that, but that was so complex that they really needed to deal with that as separate legislation. So I don't know the future of that issue. That could still have a life as standalone legislation, but that was a significant policy the governor had put forward that the committee members scaled back, or the co-chair scaled back. And another one that got some attention was that the University of Wisconsin has been pushing in recent years to exempt their research from the open records law, and that has faced opposition from both Democrats and Republicans, and was also taken out by the committee.
We're talking right now about the Joint Finance Committee's first meeting about the governor's proposed budget yesterday, talking with Patrick Marley of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And another item that attracted notice from yesterday was the decision to downsize Secretary of State Doug LaFollette's office. What happened there?
So Doug LaFollette's a Democrat who's been in office for 3 or 4 decades. And unlike other states where the Secretary of State has some significant powers, like issuing driver's licenses, incorporate businesses here to some extent, or he has some business duties, but he really has very, very few duties. And they took more away from him by saying, well, essentially that cutting his staff from 5 to 2, I think he gets a temp worker as well, and then moving him from an office space of about 4,000 square feet into the state capitol, and it's unclear exactly where he would be, but the space the governor had initially identified for him was 660 square feet that would be shared with the state treasurer, so, you know, a dramatic reduction in the amount of space he would have and the amount of staff he would have to do its work.
And what was Secretary LaFollette's reaction?
Well, he called it a train wreck and said it's going to result in some significant delays. One of the things that the Secretary of State does is gives he authenticates papers for, like, international business and international adoptions, and that will just slow down with fewer staff. And so he says that they don't know what they're in for, that people are going to be very upset about this.
Now, the committee approved cutting funding for the Citizens Utility Boards. How does that change approval of utility rates?
So the Citizens Utility Board is a group that often intervenes in ratepayer cases when utilities want to raise their rates. They come in and they make arguments that the rates shouldn't go up as much as the utilities want them to. And the state taxpayer or state ratepayers pay a portion of their fees. The committee said these folks should sort of pay their own way if they want to intervene in these cases, and reduce the amount that they would pay them. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out, with how the Citizens Utility Board is going to react to that, how they're going to be able to find the funding that they would need to be able to intervene in these cases.
Now, broadband came up yesterday as well, including funding. What did the committee decide there?
So a couple of years ago, they started giving these $500,000 grants a year that would be available to private businesses that were going to expand broadband into unserved or underserved areas. And the governor wanted to increase that significantly to about $6.5 million, and then it would taper down to about $3 million after that. The committee viewed that as a little bit too much, and so they're going with grants of about $1.5 million a year. So it's a tripling of the current money, but also a significant reduction from what the governor had wanted.
And courts came up, court funding in particular. What did the committee find?
Yeah, so that's interesting as well. The governor wanted to, right now, like any state agency, the legislature and the governor allocate a certain amount of money for different court functions. With the committee going along with this, they're sort of backing away from that and giving broader sets of money to the courts, and then leaving it to the state Supreme Court to figure out how much money to give to any particular program. They did go along with that, and so that'll give some new flexibility and powers to the court. One thing that there were a couple of things on the courts that they didn't go along with the governor on. He wanted to put the State Judicial Commission under the direct control of the Supreme Court. The Judicial Commission is responsible for investigating any kind of judicial misconduct, and then they file a complaint, sort of like a prosecutor, that goes straight to the, well, essentially goes to the Supreme Court for them to decide. And in recent years, we've had three justices be investigated by the Judicial Commission. There was some concern that you wouldn't want to put the Supreme Court in charge of the agency that investigates it, because they could defund it, they could take away staff. And even members of the court had said, you know, we think that it needs to retain its independence. That's what the committee did. So the Judicial Commission will continue to have the authority that it does today.
Now,
and then there's another... I'm sorry.
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, there's another panel called the Judicial Council that's... has a staff of one. It's a 21-person council, but they spend years going over things about procedural rules and what the best way to sort of conduct things in the courtroom would be. The governor had proposed abolishing that council. The legislators yesterday decided they would keep it.
Now, we had Mordecai Lee on earlier in the show today, former Wisconsin legislator, and he said that he thought there was a sense that the legislature right now is treating the governor almost as though he were the governor of a different party, when that they didn't have to listen to him, in particular as regards the budget. Did you see any evidence of that yesterday?
Well, it's very early in the budget process. Yesterday was the first day that the committee began taking votes on the budget. And as with every cycle, they start off with some fairly easy things. You know, although the Democrats were in dissent, they weren't dealing with things like voucher schools or cuts to school or cuts to the University of Wisconsin. And so I think we'll have to see sort of how those big issues play out. You know, school accountability is another issue. We'll see where the legislators are. You know, today the Marquette poll came out, and it showed that an idea from the governor to issue bonds to help the Milwaukee Bucks build a new arena is very unpopular. Like 79% of people were opposed to the idea. It'll be interesting to see if that makes lawmakers take a second look at that to decide if they're going to go along with the governor or if they're just going to walk away from that.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the Legislative Budget Writing Committee's first meeting yesterday.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.